This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. About 750 incarcerated people have been sentenced to death in California. One of them is William Noguera. He's a Colombian-American who grew up in a suburb of L.A., and he spent nearly 30 years on San Quentin's death row for murdering his girlfriend's mother when he was a teenager. Noguera grew up in prison. That's where he discovered his passion for art. And over the last three decades, he's become an accomplished painter and shown his work in galleries around the world. This year, Seven Stories Press published his memoir, Escape Artist, Memoir of a Visionary Artist on Death Row. KALW's Ben Trefney reached William Noguera by phone on death row to talk about his life, his crimes, and his art.
So can you describe for me where exactly you are right now?
Yes, I'm in at San Quentin Prison on the fourth tier of the East Block Bayside, which is the main housing unit for all of death row prisoners in the state of California.
What are you looking at right now?
A wall. My cell is only 4.5 feet by 9 feet deep, and I'm actually sitting with my back against the east wall, and my feet are planted against the west wall because it's that small. You can actually stand the center of my cell, stick out one arm, and I can't fully extend the other arm. And it's the same for the roof. If I reach up, I can actually touch the top of the concrete box that I live in.
And what's your day been like up to this point?
I woke up early this morning at 4:30 as I normally do. I wrote for maybe 2.5 hours on my latest literary project. I painted for about 3.5-4 hours, and then I started preparing for this interview.
And aside from the interview that we're conducting right now, is that pretty typical for your day, and how does the rest of your day play out on a general basis?
Well, normally, it really depends on what my plans are. If I decide to go outside, which I decide by 4 o'clock in the morning, 4:30, they start running yard. They pass out cuffs. And if I do go outside, I go to one of the seven different yards that are on death row. I'm on yard 6. And I spend the portion of that day working out. I basically stay to myself, and I come back in around 1 o'clock. And then I return to just what I normally do, which is writing and painting the entire night till about 12 o'clock midnight. And the day starts again at 4:30 the next morning. It's a repetitive process that I've been doing now for 30.
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
And of course, I let you know if they're listening in and recording everything that we're saying.
Yeah, and you were saying that you've been doing that same routine for over 30 years?
I have been, yes.
How do you cope with that?
It's really a matter of perspective. There are people in this world that have different prisons, physical prisons, emotional prisons, prisons of concrete, even social prisons. I've chosen to look at it in that perspective, that I'm healthy, I have a very strong mind, and I have goals to accomplish. You know, the first goal was to find myself, to understand who I was as a man, who I was as a person, and evaluate that honestly. Because the most important part is to be honest with yourself. I always have a goal. I always have a set of standards I have to meet. And that's how I cope with this situation. It's not easy. I don't think it's for everybody. And God knows I don't wish it upon my worst enemy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a situation I'm in. And I will deal with it in a positive manner.
You were 18 when you committed the crime that led you to prison. And I'm wondering if you could talk about what your childhood was like.
Well, there were very good moments. Before the age of 7, I was very happy. I had two parents who adored each other. They adored us. And I spent the first 7 years of my life in a state of happiness. I had a father who completely loved me, taught me everything I knew, from hunting and fishing to working with my hands, because both of my parents are artists. Unfortunately for them, they could not really become artists, they had to be parents and raise a family. So a very, very good childhood at the age of seven. Then came this trip that we took to South America, Colombia, to my family. And my father basically found out that he was being betrayed. And when we came back, my entire childhood just turned upside down, and it turned into a living hell full of brutality, abuse. I experienced alcoholism from my father, emotional neglect from my mother. It turned, you know, a child with a lot of optimism, a child with a lot of, you know, goodness inside of him, to a very sullen, angry child that basically didn't know his own way around his own family. And of course, there was the worst part, which was to actually deal with the racism that I went through as a child. I lived in a predominantly black and Mexican neighborhood, and since I'm not either one, I was bullied and victimized, and it was very horrible. I experienced probably the worst thing a child could go through, which was complete isolation.
So you detail in the book a very violent life. I'm wondering, how many fights have you been in?
That's a really difficult, because when I was a child, it was an everyday situation. I want you to visualize this. I would leave my house as a seven-year-old little boy, going to school in the second grade, or I may have been the third grade. And when I got to the end of my street, I had to make a choice. If I went left, the Crips would jump me and beat me up. If I went to the right, the Mexican Cholos would jump me. So every day I would walk down the street knowing that before I got to school, or as I arrived at school, I would get into a fight. Every day. My mother once, because I got beat up so badly when I was, I think, 8 years old, I had two black eyes, a broken nose, that she said, look, from now on, I'm going to give you 15 cents for your lunch and 10 cents for an ice cream. And I'm going to give you another 25 cents you put in your pocket, the first one you put in your shoe. So when those kids come to take your money, you give them the money in your pocket and they're going to leave you alone. Of course, that's the easy way out of this. And that's what any little boy should have done. But in my mind, I thought, wow, 25 cents, that's $1.25 a week. And when the first little boy came up to me, well, he wasn't that little, it was about four of them, and told me, give me your money, I told him, absolutely not. And I fought. And every single day that I can remember, from the first grade to the sixth grade, I fought every single day.
Were there adults who could help out with that? Like, did you find any at schools, or was there anybody who you felt you could really turn to for help?
Absolutely not. If I went to my father with an emotional situation, his response was immediate. It was either a backhand or, do you want to put on a dress? There was nothing back then. Outside sources couldn't help me. I couldn't go to friends. And the truth of the matter is, I didn't know how to deal with that. I didn't know how to go to somebody else. And, you know, I look back at that kid that I was, and, you know, it's very sad. And I can see how I turned to different things.
Yeah, tell me about that. What turned you to, you know, start criminal behavior?
Well, that came a little bit later on. But, you know, it was always the same thing. Bullied, not accepted. And I began to look for ways around things. I mean, I wanted to score a point for the home team. I was tired of being bullied. I couldn't fight back physically. I wasn't big enough. I was also the runt. I mean, before I turned the age of 13, I was 5 foot one, 104 pounds. I was the littlest guy in the class.
I can relate to that.
Right? So there was a part of me. I do have a mind that grasps a lot of situations very quickly. And I learned that I had a photographic memory when it came to numbers. So I began to using ways of how to get around that or use it to my advantage. I would learn as I mentioned in the book, a person's locker number. I'd open it longer. I'd take his lunch. I'd throw it away. I would take people's homework just to watch them go through some of the struggles that I went through. And that's how I really started. I began to like it. I began to like the power that I felt that I had by stealing something that wasn't mine. It's basically an ethical erosion. I drew lines, and I kept crossing those lines. As I did so, the bigger things that I did didn't seem so big anymore. I began at the age of 15 to steal cars. But I didn't just want to steal cars. I wanted to be the best car thief in the world. So I practiced. It's one of the things I do. I can't be second best, and that's probably something my father instilled in me. And that's how my criminal behavior started. It was first as a mechanism to deal with all the things I was feeling. But then I began to like it.
That's William Noguera speaking from San Quentin's death row with KLW's Ben Trefney.
California voters in the last election, they faced an opportunity to end the death penalty in California or to try to speed it up, and the majority voted to speed it up. Right now, there's several court cases that are pending to stop the block on executions from happening, even though there hasn't been an execution in the state for over a decade. That could change soon. Do you think you'll be executed someday?
You know, there's always that fear in the back of my mind. Of course, I would be a fool not to think that way. The court system could rule against me, and but I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic that everything I'm doing, that the butterfly effect is going to happen, that maybe somebody's going to notice, and I will be given an opportunity to at least state my case in front of a parole board, that I have been rehabilitated, that I'm no longer that, you know, young boy who made the grave mistakes that I've made. So I'm optimistic, but also afraid.
Yeah, I mean, there has not been an execution in the state, you know, as I said, for over a decade, but you've been incarcerated for so long, you have been on death row when there have been executions. And you said that they really jarred you.
They did. You know, it's like being right next to a slaughterhouse, and you're one of the cows in line. Of course, it jarred me. It completely shattered my state of mind. I recognized my own mortality more than I had before. And it actually changed a lot of things inside of me. That jarring, that moment of realization really brought a lot of different things into my life artistically as well. It's something that's always happened with me, which is when I go through something emotional that's very jarring or very emotional. Something happens creatively inside of me. New avenues open up. A new vocabulary is discovered. And one of those vocabularies was color in my work. When the first execution happened, when I was here, it was more than a decade ago. But it jarred me completely.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to explore the way in which you conceive of and are inspired by and what you say through your art. But before we, in our minds, get off of death row here to there, I want to know, do you know Vicente Benavidez Figueroa?
He lived very close to me, about 10 cells from me at one point, and then he was moved out of tier several years ago. I didn't know the man very well. I knew who he was, and I'd seen him a number of times walk by my cell on the way to Yard.
So for people who don't know, Vicente Figueroa was on death row for almost 25 years after being convicted of raping and murdering a toddler. But he was recently released in late April when it was revealed that medical testimony at his trial was false. So he's now 68 years old and free. How does that come across and ripple through death row?
You know, a lot of guys haven't spoken much about it, but I had the opportunity to watch him leave the gates, and it's hard to explain what I felt, because in one sense, I felt very happy for him that he was going home, that if in fact he was convicted of a crime he never committed, the most horrible thing in the world is he put in prison, especially for the murder of a child, and spent all these years trying to explain to people that, hey, look, I didn't do this. but at the end of the game, he was released. That's one side of the story. Another part of the story was that I looked at him, a 68-year-old man. When he came to prison, he had black hair, a black mustache, and to see him live in the state of mind or the state of being, physical being, that he was in was heart-wrenching. Because I, too, now no longer have black hair and a black mustache. My hair is white. My mustache is white. I came in here as a teenager, a boy. And now I'm an elderly guy. I'm in my 50s. So it jarred me to see that happen. And then a part of me also thought that I wish that someday I can experience walking out these gates, you know, into the arms of family or friends.
Now, I'd love to talk about your art. I'm wondering if you can describe some of your work. I know you've gone through several different artistic phases and evolutions in different ways. Describe something that you've recently worked on.
Right now, I'm working on a series entitled Abstract Scape. And to explain that is, I have to go to the beginning, which is my viewpoints on art. You know, art is always and will continue to be a necessity in my life. It's not a luxury. I came to art out of a need. And without that need, you basically create nothing. To me, art has never been about pretty pictures. There had to be something to be said. Otherwise, it's as relevant as wallpaper. With this particular series that is the vocabulary in abstraction, I'm basically showing the viewer the landscape of my confinement. These pieces are thunderous cascades of color that invoke emotion. And you mentioned the first execution here at San Quentin. It jarred me so much that like a tide, an ocean tide of color began to flow into my life. And I accepted that. I began to work with color. I wanted to invoke emotion. I want my paintings to be felt, not really seen. And if they are aesthetically pleasing to the eye, then so be it. But if they're ugly, then that is okay too. As long as the content and the intention that I have is, you know, you can hear it, you can feel it, then I've accomplished my goal.
You mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that you had painted for hours today already. What's your process in creating a painting?
Well, yeah, every day I spend 12 to 14 hours painting. The process is one, I don't leave a lot to chance. I control the entire process. I work on a steel bunk. I lay the structure there. I begin to build from there, from laying gesso to the paint. And I normally don't use traditional tools. I use mirrors for squeegees. The process is one always with a very deliberate intent. And for me, it's all about control. I have to do the entire thing. There has to be a connection with the painting, with the process at all times. If you lose that connection with the painting, how do you expect someone to connect with it? The painting is about everything that's internal inside of me, and I'm making it external so people can see it and look at it for enemies and for friends alike. There has to be a connection there. And that's what I hope to accomplish in my paintings, is to touch an individual. You know, some people have even told me and written that once in front of one of my paintings or artworks, that they have fallen to their knees and began laughing. In other cases, they began to cry. That person was a sensitive viewer. That person connected with that painting, and a dialogue erupted between the two of them. If that happens, I feel like I've accomplished my goal.
It strikes me that, you know, many people probably wonder how you even get paints and materials that you need on death row.
Well, we're allowed to order materials from vendors, and I order all my paint through a vendor. It's delivered to my cell, along with whatever else I need, brushes or all the materials, and from there I work. And I just create. I mean, this place kind of allows me to get away from the tyranny of connectiveness. I don't have a lot of distractions, and when my cell door closes, that fear leaves me. I'm able to abandon myself to these powers that I can invoke, but not altogether control. And that's very important to my process.
Now, tell me a little bit more about that theory of the tyranny of connectedness.
Well, today, many of people are on the internet. They're always connected to their phone. You know, I see TV commercials sometimes. People are walking and they fall over because they're so connected to this whole world of connectedness, which is the internet and all these things. And it just seems to me that you really don't do a lot of thinking. You just an automatic pilot in a way. So I don't have any of those distractions. I have, you know, distraction when I go outside, but I'm dealing with that in a compartment. I compartmentalize it. But when I get back into my cell and they close the door, there's nothing you can interrupt. I mean, even this phone, they had to bring it to me, to my cell. The food port is open. I reach out. I pick up the receiver. I make a phone call. But once that phone, I hang up that phone, I'm disconnected from everything again. So to me, that's what I call the tyranny of connectiveness, which is what everybody's dealing with mostly out there.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are really feeling that. And I've found myself, and you know, I go in and I work with inmates at San Quentin on San Quentin Radio, that there really is kind of a freedom of intellect and a depth of thought that people have and feel comfortable talking about, and talking about emotions and philosophy more so often than they do outside of the walls of San Quentin, which is ironic, really, that there's almost an intellectual freedom, maybe an emotional freedom that can come from being incarcerated because you are disconnected from what's going on in the world.
Yeah, what a price to pay, huh?
Yeah.
What a price to pay for a little bit of peace of mind and a little bit of self-awareness. But unfortunately for some of us, that is some of the keys we've looked for throughout our lives to be able to come to this particular place. But yeah, what a price. You know, you had to go to prison to find a little bit of freedom. And that almost sounds...
You have 60 seconds remaining.
That almost sounds like a cliche, but it really isn't. And I deal with that every single day.